Yeah, specifically his contact, who is either in or formerly in the FBI or CIA, calls it the pulmonary embolism pill, or the PEP.
Which definitely exists.
We all know what it really is. It's the heart attack gun.
It is the heart attack gun.
I mean, it's the same thing, but this is, I guess, the 70s version, which you still had to get in a pill.
Yeah, we've gotten so advanced.
Yeah. People say we don't make anything anymore. We're still making new kinds of heart attack guns.
I wonder what kind of tricks Joe is pulling to make sure that Kamala doesn't get her hands on the heart attack gun.
Yeah, he is one bad day away from, yeah.
I think Biden will live to be 100, but will just sundown more and more every day. And will just completely revert to a 7-year-old by the time that his second term ends. He's just going to go, he's going to go to Beijing and call Xi Jinping an Oriental.
I'd love your father, Chiang Kai-shek, man. I tell you what, man, I have smuggled heroin with him in Laos, man. The heroin, it's all opium.
Now, listen, Mr. Jinping, I've been talking to your top generals, General Cao. Listen, we've located the lab leak to General Cao has released COVID.
My favorite Biden racism thing was in 2015 or something, right before he died, he met Lee Kuan Yew and he introduced him as the wisest man in the Orient.
That's so awesome. God, I love him so much.
I know. It was 2015 or something. Hey, welcome back to another episode of Gladio Free Europe. I am going to be your host for today. I'm Liam, and I am here with Russian Sam and Halal Sam.
Hello.
Hello.
And today we also have a very special guest that you're going to know from one of our first episodes. That is James.
Hello. Very happy to be back on. Looking forward to this discussion.
We were thinking, James, that you're a real pro when it comes to conspiracies, you know, subtle government intrigue, and also kind of the era of the 70s. So I was thinking we could try to bring those streams together by looking at a movie that I know you'd seen before that the rest of us hadn't, which, from what I understand, is kind of the peak of a certain type of conspiracy cinema. So this movie, The Parallax View, directed by Alan J. Pakula, stars Warren Beatty as Joe Frady, this small-time TV reporter who fights an uphill battle trying to understand who exactly was behind the assassination of this candidate. So Joe Frady, he tries to get into this political event at the very beginning of the movie that his girlfriend, this journalist, Lee Carter, is covering. They don't let him in, and then that day, at the top of the Space Needle, this Senator Carroll, this looks like kind of an RFK-type figure, this young, popular presidential candidate, is murdered. We see two guys do it, only one of them gets caught, and as the police are trying to nab him, he falls off spectacularly off the Space Needle to his death. And a congressional commission determines that actually there was no conspiracy, and that even though we saw two shooters, the one who was killed acted alone. As he starts to investigate this crime, he realizes that some shadowy organization known as the Parallax Corporation seems to be involved in this assassination, but as soon as he ever meets anybody who knows anything about this, they turn up dead. And across the movie, Joe Frady becomes increasingly paranoid as he dives deeper. And really, the prevailing theme here is the terror that he feels about not knowing the entire truth.
Absolutely. I think that it was the peak of the 70s era paranoia films, both in terms of how close it got to really getting at something deeper than a surface level paranoia, and also genuinely the most interesting of his of those movies.
Yeah. And so you say those movies because Pakula made sort of a trilogy, starting with Klute in 71, and then going into the Parallax View, and then finishing up with All the President's Men, which is the famous adaptation of Watergate.
That is the famous limited hangout film
on this episode, I will convince you all that Richard Nixon is the most maligned man in history.
Maybe so. But in any case, yeah, like you said, all these movies that he called his political paranoia trilogy really go into the feeling of not knowing who's really in charge and being unable to change it. Especially, I would say, this one. The Parallax View is a little bit more of a thriller than the others. If you're really going to be a critic, you could say it's a bit trashier. But it's a really fun look at these themes of paranoia. And like I said, just not knowing who's in charge. And understanding that there's so much that you don't know.
I'm one of those critics. I'm not a big fan of the film. I felt that it was very contrived and confusing. And it just didn't really do it for me. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I walked in expecting something a little more fantastical, maybe a little bit more kind of a Soylent Green sci-fi.
I kind of didn't really expect to like this movie. I kind of thought, okay, I know what's coming. This is about like the assassination wave in the 60s, 70s. I kind of know what's coming. And in some ways I did know what's coming. Like there's a lot of obvious parallels between JFK and RFK and the senators killed this movie and the assassination techniques and brainwashing, all that stuff. It's stuff I know about, but it was still a lot more interesting than I thought it was in just how it captured the feeling of paranoia as the audience. It kind of creeps over you as well, which, well done, honestly, on that. Well done. So I liked it. It wasn't amazing. It wasn't like, this is blowing my mind, but I thought it was well done.
Yeah, no, I liked it too. Like I said, it's like, you mentioned paranoia. I'm sure that like, just like how, you know, like people in the 70s smoked the weakest weed ever, and it transformed their life. I'm sure if you saw this movie in 74, it might have been a lot more new than it is for us. But I think that as an examination of paranoia, it's pretty interesting. And that I would say as a thriller, it does a pretty good job with keeping you intrigued. I will say that a lot of the meat of the plot is just feels kind of arbitrary and isn't super interesting. It's very typical sort of mystery thriller kind of stuff. But there are like some really good moments that we can get into later. I know there's this very long montage scene in the middle that's really cool. Visually, though, it was photographed by Gordon Willis. And although it's pretty standard, kind of like a 70s thriller, a lot of medium shots, there are a couple things that stand out that I think are really interesting. Most famously, there's so many long shots where you can hardly see our hero, Joe Frady, at all. He's just a little dot in the horizon. There's one somewhat famous shot at the end where after a certain assassination happens, you just see this dead body slumped over on a golf cart, aimlessly driving through this massive auditorium. And I think that to me, that kind of aimlessness and hopelessness sort of represents how we all often feel when we're really in over our heads trying to learn about some kind of a conspiracy or some kind of a secret that we know is so much bigger than ourselves, that we fear we will never actually be able to understand.
And that we'll literally never get to the bottom of. Like, we're never going to know, you know, every single detail of the Kennedy assassination. There's no way. I mean, we can have our theories that are very likely true. We can talk about why George H.W. Bush was in Dallas that day. We can do a lot of specifics, but we're not going to know exactly who the second shooter was.
And at least to me, this is really where paranoia is the most painful. When you know so much that you're almost there.
Yes.
But you're never really sure who you can trust.
You get that with JFK, 9/11, a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just very easy when you're following this stuff to fall down into this pit of despair and ultimately be driven crazy by it, which is why I find that you have to adopt sort of a more zen attitude about it.
No, yeah, because, yeah, I agree. Just be philosophical about it. Like, you know, maybe our government is run by lizard people. Maybe it's run by gray aliens. Whatever, you know, just try to keep my head above water.
I just hope everyone's having a good time.
Yeah. You, Russian Sam, are the only one of us who read the book, The Parallax View, by Lawrence Singer.
Yes, I have. It's a substantially different book.
Is it, are the changes better? Or without getting too deep into the weeds, what is different about it?
I would say that the book is much better thought out. Whereas in the movie, I feel like there's more of a meandering presence of the Parallax Corporation and what they actually do. And it's left up to interpretation, essentially. It's essentially like the do-it-yourself conspiracy theory. You can plug pretty much anything you want into it. Whereas in the book, it's very clearly laid out who's doing this and why.
In the movie, the Parallax Corporation is like a little more cartoonish, kind of like, I don't know, like Spectre and James Bond, this sort of generic evil organization.
Yeah, whereas in reality, these contractors are very, very specialized and not vague at all. They do very specifically evil things.
I would actually push back on that.
Yeah, actually, I don't agree with that anymore. I mean, Blackwater's changed his name like 15 times.
In the film, it's quite clear what, I would say it's actually pretty clear what the Parallax Corporation does explicitly, which is sort of a subcontracting out of basically wet works and similar operations.
Using tactics of hypnosis to get their recruits.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Which, and I think we'll get into this a bit more later on, the outsourcing of people who are connected to a intelligence agency but are doing things not necessarily in the name of the intelligence agency is certainly not a new concept. I mean, you really have to look at perhaps one of the most famous examples of specifically involving hypnosis and, well, in this case, much more drug-related experiments was the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic in California.
Where a certain Charles Manson walked into, I believe.
A certain Charles Manson and operated by, in part, by a certain Dr. Jolly West, who was... I believe that we will get into him later, but...
Well, I don't see how a man named Jolly could possibly do anything malicious.
And, you know, James, so you obviously are a bit of a an old hand at conspiracies. And just before we get too involved in the plot of the movie or anything like that, you know the way he feels in this movie, did that strike an emotional chord with you?
Oh, absolutely. If I remember correctly, the director's... So Pakula's direction, right, to Beatty was, if I remember correctly, he said that the point of your performance is to cause the feeling of not trusting the person next to you. That was basically the performance notes that he gave Warren Beatty, which is just... It's such a cool thing to say in general as a director.
Well, one thing I will say about the movie is that it's very fitting with the zeitgeist.
Absolutely.
You can't trust anybody, trust nobody. Like, this was right after the Watergate scandal hit. The malfeasance of the American government and the FBI and the CIA were increasingly coming into public view.
Which we know it would all be cleaned up.
Yeah. No, and then even more than Watergate, this was just a few years after so many assassinations that I think really are what set the tone, especially for the novel. Just the fact that within 5 years, you have not only the JFK assassination, but also the killings of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Robert F. Kennedy, in such a quick succession. And in every case, it really seems like a big segment of the public felt like they weren't getting the full story.
Because they weren't.
Exactly. Well, even beyond that, I would like to bring up the fact that this is a 1974 film, and the MK Ultra program did not become public record until the Church Committee revealed it in 1975, just a year later. So this is clearly, I think you can pick up from this, the fact that it is included not only in the film, but also in the earlier book, is that there was an understanding that something wasn't right. That people understood that things like hypnotism or some other sort of suggestion could and perhaps was being actively used by intelligence services, whether it was American or, as every American psychologist connected to it, accused the Soviets of doing.
You know, speaking of the zeitgeist, I think it's super interesting that this movie came out the same year as Chinatown, which I hope... you've all seen, which is another really paranoid, basically conspiracy thriller. It's a different kind of movie. It's got more of a film noir vibe. But what I find really interesting is that actually they had the same screenwriter, because somehow the tireless Robert Town did an uncredited rewrite on the Parallax View. And that might have something to do with why there is a very similar feeling of paranoia and of terror that you see in Chinatown, and why also there are some pretty significant differences from the book.
I would like to say that the film writing of the script was a victim of a Hollywood writer's strike.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Which I assume is why he's uncredited, because he was a scab.
Mm-hmm. So Pakula, at the very least, had to, I believe the town wrote the rewrite of it, right?
That's correct, yeah.
And then Pakula basically had to rewrite it again on the fly as he was directing, because not only was there a writer's strike, there was also, not contract, but basically like time disputes with Howard Beatty. In terms of how long they had him to film for.
In that case, let me add, Mr. Town, if you are listening to this, now that I know the full story, I apologize for suggesting that you are a scab.
Yeah, and I would like to say, Chinatown, I am not going to imply anything criminal about Mr. Pakula, but I will say that it's interesting that Chinatown, directed by, of course, Roman Polanski, there is, well, you know, his wife was in a certain house on a certain fateful day.
That's true.
Who knows what happens?
and well, that brings us back. If this isn't getting too far off, why don't you tell us about that free clinic in the Haight-Ashbury that you mentioned, why you think that's relevant to this movie, and why it interests you in general?
Absolutely. So I'm getting a lot of this from an excellent book, Chaos, by Tom O'Neill, about specifically the Manson family. There was a man who had an office at the Haight-Ashbury Medical Clinic, right?
And just for anyone who isn't aware, for anyone who was born after, you know, 1975, Haight-Ashbury was the hippie district of San Francisco.
Of course, one of the people who often was seen hanging around it was, of course, Charlie Manson himself, along with a few of his associates.
Okay, come on, they're family.
Yes, the fam. One of the people who had an office at the Haight-Ashbury Medical Clinic was a man named Dr. Louis Jolyon West, or Dr. Jolly West, as he was most known. He first gained prominence nationally for, quote-unquote, deprogramming returning American POWs from the Korean War, who had been, at least according to the U.S. government, brainwashed by the North Korean forces.
This is kind of the beginning of brainwashing in, like, the American public conscience.
Yeah, and of course, another movie that's often compared to this one, which came out a few years before, is The Manchurian Candidate.
I would actually push back, because I have even earlier examples of people like Dr. West talking about brainwashing and hypnotism.
Oh, no, I mean in the public consciousness.
Oh, yeah, you're probably right.
Like, there were obviously people still trying this stuff and obsessed with it much before. World War II alone had a lot of that shit.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Oh, really? No, that's beyond me.
Again, just to get into the types of things that Dr. Jolly West and the others at the Haight-Ashbury Clinic were involved with. He infamously, or famously, depending on who you like, examined Jack Ruby while he was in prison. Basically, he fought very hard to get on this trial. In a couple of the documents among his papers that he left to, I believe, the University of California, that Tom O'Neill was able to get access to. In a couple of those, he said he was, quote, asked by someone to get involved in the Ruby trial, although he never says by who.
Can you remind our listeners who Jack Ruby was?
A patriot, an American hero.
Jewish excellence.
A man who is simply worried about a grieving widow. And that's all there is to say about it. So if you know anything about the trial that was they attempted to put Ruby on, before he died of complications from cancer. Let's leave it at that for now.
He died of Hugo Chavez cancer.
Yeah, basically. So he was able to get one-on-one alone time with Jack Ruby in his cell. You know, he goes in, he's in there for I don't know how many hours. he leaves, and suddenly Jack Ruby, who before then had been checked by multiple psychiatrists to be of sound mind and body, suddenly was screaming about the fact that they needed to get him in contact with a Jewish senator, any Jewish senator in Washington, because in Albuquerque, he claimed, and elsewhere in New Mexico, they were, quote, chopping up Jewish babies by the limbs, and was completely inconsolable when they attempted to put him on the stand to testify to anything. It's all he would talk about.
Yeah, and so just to confirm, you were suggesting that in that moment, he would have been somehow drugged.
Something happened to him, because there is a clear delineation in his mental state before and after meeting this one doctor.
Absolutely. He was never coherent again.
No, he was never coherent again.
And would you say the same thing happened to Charles Manson?
Ooh, that is a bigger question.
Something happened to Manson, but he never broke completely mentally that way. Whatever they did to Manson is more complicated.
Hey, Manson is far more complicated. Far, far, far more complicated case. But I would like to just finish up this little jaunt into Dr. Jolly by saying that, of course, neither Alan Dulles nor Richard Helms reported to the Warren Commission when they were testifying to it their knowledge of West's employment by the CIA, which, of course, they had full knowledge of.
So this phantom thread linking arguably the two possibly biggest killers, most significant killers of the 60s, that was never officially acknowledged.
Absolutely. Yeah, and of course, West also in 65 wrote a paper called The Dangers of Hypnosis, which asserted hypnosis could make people so pliable that they would violate their moral codes, as contrary to popular wisdom suggests, and have no memory of it afterward.
And this was all purely hypothetical for him, of course.
And he said that just because such circumstances were rare didn't mean they were impossible. And he cited, quote, military offense induced experimentally at an undisclosed U.S. Army base, and also an actually reported 1951 double murder and serial bank robbing case in Copenhagen, Denmark, in which one man hypnotized another into, again, robbing a series of banks and committing a pretty brutal double murder.
And of course, for those of us, for those who haven't seen the movie, hypnosis is a really major plot point, because we find out that these assassinations in the film of various presidential candidates, mostly during the run-up to an election, are all being coordinated by this group, the Parallax Corporation. And our hero, Joe Frady, actually undergoes this hypnosis himself when he's undercover. I know, Russian Sam, you had a lot of thoughts on the hypnosis montage, right?
Yeah, I felt that the montage was the most compelling part of the movie. It's a juxtaposition of words followed by pictures.
Very Clockwork Orange.
It starts fairly normally. Like, it starts with the word glove, followed by pictures of happy couples, and then mother, and then pictures of moms, fathers, pictures of fathers, and me. It's like a boy growing up into adulthood, and then home. It's just fairly typical stuff. Country, you got Statue of Liberty, Washington, Lincoln, and then finally you get to the interesting stuff where you get the enemy, and you see a photo of a Nazi rally, of Hitler, of Mao, and of Fidel.
Lee Harvey Oswald, too.
yeah. They slipped him in there.
Well, Oswald shows up multiple times in here. In fact, so I have written here, love, mother, father, me, home, country, God, enemy.
Me comes up a lot, that word.
Yep, me comes up a lot, and there are a lot of quick shots of me, and then followed by a photograph of Lee Harvey Oswald.
They start by introducing these fairly normal concepts and these fairly normal pictures, and then, like, you start running through them again, and then father, it's just, like, these old, decrepit men who are clearly miserable. And then mother, again, it's woman from the Great Depression. And then it's home and dirty children. And as you go through the montage, it's sort of like it all bleeds together in a way. Like, you're seeing a lot of these same pictures come in. So, like, for example, at some point you get country and it's the Nazi rally and Hitler once again show up.
Instead of enemy, yeah.
Specifically, I'm actually going to push back for a second on that. it's not just German Nazi rallies. There are actually, if I'm correct, photographs of American Nazi Party rallies.
Yeah, the German-American Bund. It's the one in Madison Square Garden. Everyone knows the photo.
That's wild, yeah. Speaking of kind of weird Aryan stuff, they kept also showing the Mighty Thor for Marvel Comics.
Absolutely, yep. Yeah. So this will tie into who is recruited by the Parallax Corporation.
Well, so quick question. So why do you think the film was making those Nazi parallels? Were they trying? Was this just kind of like a shock value thing, showing that the Parallax Corporation is so unscrupulous they would convince Americans that their state is as bad as the Nazis? Or do you think that was a deeper political sentiment?
I think it was multiple layers, right? I think one layer is that clearly the point of this montage is to confuse and stir up so many emotions. We should know before we go on, the people recruited by the Parallax Corporation are those who you have to pass, quote unquote, a psychological evaluation. Passing it, in order to pass it, you have to basically come back as a violent psychopath. It, like, in the medical sense, you have to show up as that.
Yeah, but also, like, the test itself, it's just very innocuous stuff. Like, it, in some ways, it's very similar to the kinds of screening that they do for like, menial jobs that you apply to these days.
And what do you think that they're trying to get at with these questions? Like, what do you think is their intention?
I think that it's an ill-conceived way of figuring out, like, a person's mental state.
I think there's definitely an element to that. I think also a lot of those questions are, if you had to ask me to come up with something, I would include a lot of questions that are designed to basically get someone in, to use that word again, a hypnotic state, a bit of a trance that you get into when you're being asked a bunch of inane, seemingly meaningless questions, is your brain kind of shuts off and you kind of stop thinking so much about it.
Like in the book, he's brought in to take this examination, but whereas in the movie, he just finds the survey among the belongings of one of the Parallax assassins, and he just fills it out and mails it into them.
Yeah, specifically, he did not fill it out, actually. He went to, he went to the mental health facility and had someone who was basically diagnosed as a violent psychopath to actually fill it out for him. Fill it out as accurately as he could. And I would like to also add that in that scene, there are scientists attempting to teach a monkey how to game.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
Which is just delightful. They have him playing Pong, I believe. It's very 70s. Yeah. So back to that brainwashing scene, right? So the movements are from traditional Americana to an almost psychedelic sort of setting, these strange images that seem out of nowhere. One of the most important things actually is consistently as it comes up with father and mother and home, father, mother and home, are these images of a man holding a belt very angrily. There is an image that's repeated a lot, which is, I believe that you can kind of see like a stern, like a kind of like flexing arm as if in anger, form of a man as a small naked boy is running down the hallway, the image is showing him trying to escape some sort of beating from his father. And then the mother is either just a mother who is kind of looking away or a mother who appears to have been abused herself. All of this, again, is meant to, especially for the candidates they are doing, in my opinion, bring up and recall in the same vein of trying to stir up all these emotions and confuse people, bring up what is most likely in the early childhood of someone who is so disturbed, especially in the understanding of the time of how those with such conditions come to be, is stirring up childhood trauma, very violent and very repressed childhood trauma.
You are trying to make someone come unglued.
Absolutely.
And of course, back to Manson, that was a man who was horribly traumatized, you know, spent his whole childhood in various, you know, state institutions.
Yes. State institutions where conditions in those prisons were, it would make any British boarding school look like summer camp.
it's that is it, just in terms of the physical abuse that young boys faced. It's just truly horrific that anyone ever had to go through that. And I say this as if it's past tense, but you know. But I would like to bring up in the context of one of the earliest proponents of those connected to the American intelligence state of hypnotism is George Estabrooks. Esty, if you're nasty. In 1943, he wrote and published a book called Hypnotism, which was partly published through the U.S. government. And so one of the things, just quickly, because we will talk about him, I think, more in a bit, but one of the important things is that when abuse is of extreme nature, the natural reaction is to build walls around such experiences by creating a separate and distinct personality to deal with future episodes of abuse. Once the core personality is split, it is then possible to control one or more alters, as I believe he called them, or maybe they were called later, without conscious knowledge of the primary personality.
And was he prescribing this as potential government tactic, or was he just acknowledging this possibility?
Are you asking what he would say, or what he was actually doing?
His concept of the super spy, I think later. But just to quote briefly from him, multiple personality could be both caused and cured by hypnotism. Remember that war is a grim business. Suppose we deliberately set up that condition of multiple personality to further the ends of military intelligence. The justification he gives in this book, and many others like him gave, was referring to such methods of purposely breaking down an individual, as he calls it, the Russian method. And of course, the justification was...
The Soviets are doing it, we should too. That's hilarious projection.
Not only just as later there would be a missile gap, which of course the missile gap never existed.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
He was convinced that there is a brainwashed assassin gap.
That's...
And I will leave it up to the listeners to determine whether they think that existed as well.
And of course, that is just so typical of, I would say, the American state, is that they manufacture a crisis happening elsewhere and say, therefore, we have to be just as bad.
I also find it interesting how much of this stuff has corporate origins. I mean, for example, the case of Edward Bernays, who was this big advertising executive, he wrote a bunch of books about advertising techniques that were very influential. He orchestrated some very successful psychological advertising campaigns, such as convincing the public or a certain segment of the public that women smoking cigarettes was a subversive act of liberation and blah, blah, blah. And just going back to the actual survey, as we see in the movie and the book, it's just pure corporate mumbo-jumbo that's imposing itself upon us that ultimately jumps the ship and becomes an explicit arm of the state. Rather than to just sell cigarettes or nylons or whatever, now the purpose is to sell America.
If we can take a step back from all of the really crazy, interesting backstory from the hypnosis for a second, and go back to the movie itself. I know that there are a couple things that you guys found interesting about, like, the kind of the physical production. Like, there was, just before the hypnosis scene, another interesting visual spectacle, which is the boat scene, where our hero Joe Frady goes to interview somebody who witnessed one of these assassinations, and then as soon as he finishes talking to this guy, they're out in the yacht, and then what happens?
There is a bomb planted on the boat. Our hero, Joe, notices it just in time to jump off the boat into the water as we see a pretty cool, practical effects explosion of this boat in the ocean. It's
before, and I might add, before Jaws. So they did the boat explosion even earlier.
It's a pretty good explosion, I do have to say. But I do believe that it probably used up a good amount of the budget they had. Because later, there is a bomb placed on an airplane. And that one is an off-screen explosion. And we know it exploded because the camera shakes really, really fast. And there's an explosion sound effect. And that's as much as we get.
Man, that plane scene was so cool. Freddy just like walks onto the plane without a ticket, without anything, no security, and he just pays for it on the flight itself.
Bring it back. Bring it back.
Oh, you know what? We're gonna have to talk about how 70s this movie is. Because again, I had the same thing.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. No, number one, no plane security.
Nope. You are literally allowed to walk around on the runway, just whatever. You can buy tickets on the plane.
It's like a fucking train. It's like going on NJ Transit or some shit. Like
So what happens in this scene, just a quick little overview. Joe Frady, he kind of knows what's going on. He's met the Parallax Corporation, and he knows that this guy, whose name was Gillingham, I think, some politician, is on this plane.
Specific, Gillingham is one of the two. He is set up as, in my mind, implied to be the Democratic party nominee for president.
Right. And the Parallax Corporation doesn't like him. And so it seems like they want him dead. And so Joe Frady, he sneaks onto this plane. And what he does is he realizes he has to stop this assassination. And he does it in a pretty cool way where he has an inkling that there's a bomb on the plane. So he runs into the bathroom just, I believe it's just after takeoff. And then he writes on the window, "There is a bomb on the plane." But then unfortunately, as soon as he opens the door, he almost gets caught. Someone sees him. And because he doesn't want to be, you know, found out, he quickly wipes it off and he has to think of a new strategy. How do I get these people off this plane? And then even worse, by the time he gets out of the bathroom, the plane's already in the air.
Yeah, he has to reach into the drink cart and quickly scrawl a note on a napkin and put it back without anyone seeing him so that, of course, he can simply run off of the runway without... Once the plane is forced to land, he is able to simply just get away from the police waiting to intercept the passengers of this plane.
Yeah, and he writes on the napkin, "There is a bomb on the plane." He slips it under the napkin stack, and then a few minutes later, you know, the flight attendant, while she's giving out napkins and drinks, she sees this napkin with the mark.
Let's be error appropriate. Let's call her what she was, a stewardess.
Yes, again, it was the 70s. Yes. No, I know that James. I know that you mentioned that you saw this film with a lot of lesbians, and they were very interested in let's just say the presentation of women in this film.
I get the sense that these particular ladies had an affinity for, let's say, women's fashion of the 1970s, particularly the common combination of turtleneck sweaters and lack of wearing a bra.
Oh yeah, it was the 70s. You know, the blunts were blazing, and so were the bras, all going up in smoke.
So the committee report. This is a scene that basically bookends the film. The same setup and basically lines down to the basically line line up and bookend the beginning and the end of this film. It is a shot of a congressional, you know, committee in a courtroom, right? And what you see are these members of Congress, right? You know, sitting at the bench, and essentially. What they say is basically ripped from the initial Warren Commission.
Once again, for people who were born after 1975, the Warren Commission was the official Supreme Court investigation about the Kennedy assassination.
Presidential Commission assassination. It just happened to be headed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Oh, okay. Earl Warren, yeah.
It's the one with the magic bullet theory, single shooter, you know the drill.
The kind of official story of the JFK assassination.
We should actually specify that it was the first commission on the JFK assassination.
Yes.
There would, of course, be other follow-up ones.
House Committee on Assassinations.
And we actually mentioned the Warren Commission earlier in this very episode. Specifically, the fact that neither Alan Dulles nor Richard Helms reported when they were testifying under oath to the Warren Commission that they had no knowledge of Jolly West's employment by the CIA.
That's hilarious.
That's one word for it.
Well, so funny you should mention, you know, Jolly West. I'm just kind of curious, like, he does seem to be an interesting link to this fictional company, an analog to the Parallax Corporation. What other elements of this movie's story reminded you of what you believe may be real world conspiracies?
Sure. So there are a couple organizations that the Parallax Corporation, for example, reminded me of, especially in its very early on portrayal. The first couple glimpses we get into the Parallax Corporation. One thing that I noticed is that there was a certain, in terms of the relationship between this ostensibly private corporation and mental health care / patients, you know, and then intelligence, is the Human Potential Movement, which emerged again in California in this time. It was basically a competitor in this 60s, 70s era to Scientology and the various Scientology branches that would go on to form their own mini cults, their own strange little webs of your synonyms, your whatnot, right?
Yeah. And I think it's probably no coincidence that this film is set all across the West Coast, where basically all of these cults were, you know, and even non-cult weird organizations, like, as you mentioned, the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic.
Specifically, the Parallax Corporation, I completely forgot it was called this. Their Division of Human Engineering is where Frady is, of course, trained, which is in Los Angeles, and that is where he is shown the montage. Frady, of course, is from Oregon. The initial assassination takes place in Washington. So there is sort of this, I would actually say, as a out-and-out East Coaster, absolutely. I will say the impression I get of the West Coast is that if you want to call Southern California the imperial core of the West Coast, the periphery is the Pacific Northwest, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't the Pillar Periphery be more inland?
Well, coast specifically.
Because Seattle is a major center of capital, especially tech.
Well, Seattle, the biggest thing they had was Boeing, other certain companies involved in a certain industry.
Yes. Yeah. I would say it's quite close to the Imperial Corps' heart.
You have to elaborate on that, James.
Well, so Seattle specifically was home to a lot of jobs that actually drew people to moving to Seattle in the early to mid 20th century, were jobs with aerospace companies such as Boeing and other, again, aerospace companies which had defense contracts. And of course, a broad history of the city of Seattle, as far as I understand, is the grunge movement. To contextualize this for a bit, anyone who's not super familiar with basically the transition that happened in Seattle, is from aerospace to bullshit tech jobs, is the grunge movement arose basically out of the deindustrialization of Seattle.
Right.
Yeah, so if you think about that as kind of the transition period, the 90s. In the 70s, you start to see deindustrialization, but not as severely as it would be in the 80s and, of course, in the 90s. So, again, it is absolutely very interesting that it's on the West Coast specifically.
Let's go back to this. What else does this movie in particular remind you of about real-life conspiracies?
Oh, you want to talk about Sirhan Sirhan? Let's talk about...
Yeah, and I think that RFK, more than JFK, seems to be really setting the stage for this movie.
It is, especially because the accused shooter, right, was involved with hypnosis and whatnot, right?
Of RFK, Sirhan Sirhan.
Yeah, Sirhan. As opposed to Oswald, hypnotism, there's really no evidence of hypnotism.
He's just an asset.
Yeah, he was set up.
He was set up, but he was also an asset still. You set up your own assets all the time.
Well, so if we can take a step back, so Sirhan Sirhan, who was, you know, convicted of shooting RFK, he was a Palestinian Christian who was a horse jockey, right?
Yep. Very short man.
Yeah, a short king, if you will.
If you will. Who again had his own traumatic childhood experience of seeing one of his siblings die when he was a small child. And again, as you can imagine, a person who grew up, at least especially the early years of their life, in Palestine in this era, this person is going to be facing a lot of trauma, which again, as we know, when it comes to hypnotism, when it comes to these things, it is much, much, much easier to enter a suggestible state
if you are using real trauma, real either physical, emotional, or mental trauma, that is the most effective, is what, and this isn't just me, this is coming from people like Estabrooks and his cohorts.
And I'm sorry, who are these people?
Oh, sorry. These are basically, you can think of contemporaries, basically, of Estabrooks and West.
Oh, also writing about the potentials of hypnosis.
Yes, of course, Paul Verdier wrote a book called Brainwashing and the Cults, in which he lays the blame for people being brainwashed at the foot of satanic cults and the Soviet Union.
Right, right. And I was speaking of of cults and trauma. I know famously there was that, I'm sure you back to Oregon, there was that one Hindu cult in the, I believe in the 90s, that was in the Pacific Northwest.
Rajneeshis?
I think that's it. And speaking of trauma, I believe they specifically targeted Holocaust survivors as potential recruits, probably knowing that these people had endured such unbelievably horrific trauma that they'd be potentially more willing to join this cultish organization.
Yeah, and of course, those who were very willing to see their own religion as having failed them in a time of crisis and be willing to adopt this truly psychotic cult derivation of some fucked up Hindu guy. But yeah, so on the topic of Sirhan Sirhan, I do have a couple of things. So I'm going to approach this topic as if we all agree that Sirhan Sirhan did not, there was no forensic evidence that he pulled, that he fired even a single bullet in the Ambassador Hotel, that he certainly did not kill Robert Kennedy, and that he is, he was essentially a patsy from the get-go. And the fact that he continues to profess his innocence, despite the fact that he's serving, he's still in prison under horrific conditions, and could potentially get better treatment if he simply confessed to something that he didn't do. The fact that he has not and continues to uphold this thing, again, why would he unless he truly believes he did not do it?
And so just to take a step back, and you think you was, did Sirhan Sirhan assert that he was hypnotized, or did he assert that he had no connection to this crime at all?
He asserts that he does not remember, in a similar way as Jack Ruby actually claims that he has no memory of actually shooting Oswald. Jack Ruby actually claimed that he remembers walking into the building, and whether this is true or not, different story. He claimed at the time that he remembered walking into the building
where the police had held Oswald.
Yep, and of course the door that normally was locked, of course, was conveniently left unlocked so that he could approach the police as they were carrying Oswald away. He claims that he does not remember anything prior, basically, to going there, up until he's being tackled by the police, at which point he does exclaim, what's happening? What's going on?
Yeah. And what about Sirhan Sirhan? So what does Sirhan Sirhan say happened, and what do you think may have happened?
So Sirhan, he, to this day, claims he does not remember any of that happening. He essentially claims that he was in a fugue state and that he does not know what happened, which I frankly believe.
Do you think he had been under some kind of hypnosis or anything like that? Or
I think he most certainly had been. I think he most certainly had been. He was, of course, a susceptible guy to begin with. He was, of course, he was consciously getting himself involved with people who taught hypnotism as a skill, which is, of course, the Rosicrucians. Not in sort of Masonic conspiracy way. No, he voluntarily went to join the Rosicrucians because, for some reason, he sought spiritual enlightenment.
And they are, if I am getting this right, they are this very sub-Rosa Catholic monastic order who, from what I understand, may not monastic, some kind of religious group that was very interested in the possibility of immortal life.
Whether I would call them Catholic, I do not know. Certainly the Catholic Church is not considered to be Catholic. Sort of the same way that groups claiming to be descendants from the Templars will claim that they are upholders of the one true religion, right? And that they were unfairly suppressed by the church. But at this point in time, it was
partly a, if you want to call it a new religious movement, largely inspired by Christianity, but with a lot of New Age and Hermetic and other influences on their belief system.
I didn't realize that they were kind of a, there was like a revival of them in the 70s, but that makes a lot of sense because actually, you know, Leonard Cohen has a line.
In the 60s, but yes.
Yeah, yeah, where, you know, Leonard Cohen has a line where he tells like a wayward youth to go join the Rosicrucians.
Yeah, they promised things such as you will be able to, if you listen to these hypnotism tapes, right, because they believed in the power of hypnotism and suggestion to unlock innate ability, which this is getting really into the weeds. But again, this is a group that claimed if you tried hard enough, you could basically use the force. You could levitate stuff with your mind, all of that stuff.
And Sirhan was involved with these guys.
Yeah. And whether he was actually involved with the Rosicrucians themselves or a front group posing as Rosicrucians is up for debate. I am going to actually quote very briefly from Alan Dulles about the topic of hypnosis. He says, quote, "The brain becomes a phonograph playing a disc put on its spindle by an outside genius over which it has no control." This is what we really get to with the topic of hypnotism in this film is... Again, this is a year before MKUltra. So they don't necessarily know, I think, all about, in the film at least, and again, in the book, obviously, they didn't know. They're more removed. The level of involvement of things like drug experimentation being used. At this time, they're still basically operating off of mid-60s to before understanding of how to create this quote-unquote super spy, which is through... hypnotism.
Do you think the kind of hypnotism that was actually being used potentially by government agencies at this time, would it have looked anything like what we see in this movie? That kind of the hypnotism montage?
I don't think so. I think the most interesting thing is that this montage gets very, very close to what I think at the time they attempted to do with hypnotism.
Oh, really? How so?
They focus on traumatic and abusive breaking down of a personality, which again the montage does by attempting to trigger memories of childhood physical, if not worse, abuse.
In a sense, that might make it a little bit more interesting, especially more emotionally interesting than the montage that it is so often compared to from A Clockwork Orange, which is more about, you know, shock value and word associations kind of stuff.
Yep. It's in my opinion, it is, I love Kubrick, but it is such a fascinating, at the very least, because of the images that it uses. It doesn't simply use shocking images. It is word association with things that are meant to evoke a specific emotional response in a specific type of person, which is a violent psychopath who most likely was believed at the time to have suffered severe abuse as a child, at the very least. So again, I'm gonna go back to Esther Brooks and his concept of the super spy. Quote, "Everyone could be thrown into the deepest state of hypnotism by the use of what I termed the Russian method. No holds barred, deliberate disintegration of the personality by psychic torture. The subject might easily be left a mental wreck, but war is a grim business." He very much liked this phrase, war is a grim business. The idea at this time, right, was that to achieve truly lasting mind control required creation of profound and deep emotional states. The recommended states were fear, shock, and anxiety because they have a quote, "intense disinhibitive effect on the human brain. The whole point is to break down the inhibitions of committing violent acts." Actually, again, Paul Verdier actually said that the most effective of these is pain because, as he says, quote, "according to the eminent neurologist Dr. Wilder Penfield," who was, of course, who was an associate of Dr. Ewan Cameron, who is a medical torture expert and an MKUltra operative, Verdier claims that sensations of pain from the muscular sensory system enter the subcortical brain regions directly. So again, if this was accurate to what such psychologists at the time are saying, this would not be simply you sit in a chair and you watch a movie. it would be far, far worse and far more intense. There would be a physical torture aspect.
So it's not only building off past trauma, it's actively traumatizing you further.
Yes, it is the act of re-traumatization, which is the interesting thing this gets to. The montage scene is attempting to emotionally re-traumatize these people. However, in real life, of course, any psychologist who, you know, a quote-unquote psychologist, who attempted to carry out such experiments would have been using physical torture as they considered it one of the most effective methods.
And now I just have to ask, gun to your head, do you think Sirhan Sirhan or any assassin from this era was subject to this kind of state-sanctioned torture?
I'm going to say certainly when it comes to anyone who it can be proven had direct contact with psychologists who were employed by the CIA at the time, I think it is safe to say certainly in its most primitive states, which again is the 1940s, in its most primitive states, it was physical torture that they attempted to use. However, when you get to, even in Paul Verdier, right, even in this book, Brainwashing of the Cults, right, even at this point, he says things like, you know, the goal of mind control is to access areas of the brain outside conscious control of individual by circumventing normal inhibiting responses of cerebral cortex. An individual's voluntary conscious self-control must be bypassed or short-circuited. And he said specifically to disable the brain's what he called the cortical block to do this. He recommended alcohol, euphoric drugs, isolation, solitary confinement, and hypnosis. He called, of course, hypnosis, quote, the most dramatic and unique item in the brainwashing arsenal. So again, euphoric drugs, isolation, solitary confinement, and to some degree alcohol, although, you know, once LSD was invented, they were pretty much like, okay, this alcohol is just kid stuff. Come on. Give me the real chemicals.
Although I'm sure any bachelorette party hypnotist could tell you that alcohol definitely does probably make people better at being hypnotized.
Oh, it absolutely certainly makes you more susceptible or more suggestible.
I'm sure, you know, bachelorette party strippers would tell you the same thing.
But again, as chemicals such as LSD were not only invented, but used in these specific contexts, they discovered, again, as Dr. Jolly West did and others at the Haight-Ashbury Medical Clinic did, it is incredibly easy to get people to be suggestible when you dose them with LSD, particularly without their knowledge, although sometimes even with their knowledge.
Do we have any hard evidence of anybody in this time or in any time being hypnotized in a process like this and then committing a crime? Are there any confirmed cases of this? Because I have to admit, I am still a little bit skeptical of hypnosis in general, but I'm really curious to know what documented cases we know have happened that may be an analog to what might have happened with Sirhan Sirhan and the characters in this film.
I also very much share your skepticism of hypnosis. And I think so did the CIA, which is why they moved on from it to direct chemical interactions with the brain, with LSD, right? Although, again, I will bring up again, and this case, this argument still has stood up in court. The 1951 Copenhagen hypnosis double murder case. That is still a case in which it is still upheld by the courts that the man was indeed hypnotized into doing it and therefore cannot be held wholly responsible. Which, of course, there are other crimes around the world, which courts have seen as mitigating circumstances, perhaps being things like Stockholm Syndrome, right? You could consider Stockholm Syndrome a type of hypnosis, if you want, in the much broader sense of the term.
Because it's a traumatic experience that changes how you think about something, right?
Exactly. And it is done specifically in order to manipulate another person to behave or act in a certain way that you desire them to.
And I'm sure that's basically the basis of so many cult operations is, you know, the cult leader essentially traumatizes people through various forms of abuse and in the process sometimes incurs loyalty.
Why, it absolutely is. It's almost like they were in contact with some of the same doctors, especially in California of this era.
That Dr. Jolly always comes back, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Well, this is all really, really crazy heavy stuff, James. So thank you so much for coming on and talking about this.
Thank you for having me. I had an absolute blast.
No, absolutely. And I got to say, this was not an amazing movie, but having, you know, spoken about it with you has really kind of brought it out in a really, really interesting new light.
It's not the best movie, but I think of the trilogy, it is certainly the most interesting.
It's way better than All the President's Men, which is just...
Oh, because both of you are Nixon truthers.
Well, it's more that Watergate was a limited hangout.
Yeah, Watergate was a limited hangout. Was he actually even involved in Watergate? Who knows? Also, I'm just going to say it, he was a cool guy.
Nixon?
The Quakers were unjustly persecuted.
Yeah, I mean, well, to be fair, he was like the worst kind of Quaker, which is the evangelical Quaker. He was not like a cool, like, Philadelphia Quaker. But, he did, at least according to Adam Curtis, which I unfortunately have been able to find no actual backing up evidence to support this happening, told his analyst, "When I look at myself in the morning, I don't see anything there," which is such a cool thing. You know what?
So he just admitted to being a vampire.
Yeah, he's a vampire, which means women think he's sexy.
All right, well, maybe one of these days I'll have to come around on Tricky Dick. But, you know, but before we really finish off tonight, you know, mentioning Nixon and the Republican Party, one thing that I was thinking about a lot through watching this movie was the fact that it's about a very paranoid conspiracy theory. In the context of this movie, it's about a conspiracy that we learn is obviously true, but I also was kind of thinking of conspiracies that are most likely not true. And I was kind of curious, or I guess I should say curious, about how you think the parallax view, or what implications the parallax view might have to the kind of paranoid conspiracy theories, not real life conspiracies, but conspiracy theories that exist on the internet today, especially conspiracy theories involving satanic cabals or cannibalism or lizard people or any of that.
I mean, Q is obviously a psyop. Like, this is not something that comes up organically.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, well, I think I've said before how the fundamental thing that's very funny about Q, but the fact that it's a conspiracy theory where ultimately the message is, and this is why you should trust the government.
Yeah, nothing else works like that. It's an insane conspiracy theory.
I would say that Q is basically the best kind of conspiracy for the government in that, yeah, it tells people that everything's under control, trust the plan, and if you believe hard enough and if you missionize hard enough and you get people to understand the situation, then someday soon we're going to be saved.
You don't have to do anything. You don't have to actually do anything. Like, you can just sit there and be confident that the white hats or whatever are going to beat the pedos.
Yeah. No, I guess the real conspiracy involving Q is the conspiracy, presumably, of government agents who pushed this conspiracy theory all across onto so much of the population. But let's hear what James has to say.
So I absolutely agree. I think it's quite obvious that whether or not they created it, certainly certain actors within the U.S. state have promoted QAnon as it is.
Yeah, well, just the fact that several current and former military officials, you know.
Including people in intelligence positions.
Including a certain father-son epic duo.
Again, Irish excellence. Michael Flynn. What's his son's name? Is it just Michael Flynn Jr.?
Michael Flynn Jr., yes.
Yeah, because he knows one name, and it's his own name.
Well, it's kind of like George Foreman named all of his sons George.
Well, that's just cool. I can't even knock him for that. That's just cool.
Well, so what do you think the Parallax View, 1974 film by Pakula, can tell us about Q?
Sure. So my biggest takeaway from Parallax View as it relates to the topic of real life conspiracy theories, right? Ones which are not exactly very substantiated in reality, but exist, like, again, like QAnon does.
Before you do, I think we should make a distinction between, that is so rarely made, is the distinction between conspiracy theories, which are ideas that are, which are notions, sometimes correct, sometimes not, about groups in power, and actual conspiracies.
Which do exist.
Yes, we absolutely exist, which are real life, oftentimes secretive, power sharing or power taking agreements.
Or I mean just any, like any scheme between many people that like, the official 9/11 narrative involves a conspiracy between members of Al-Qaeda.
A great example of the difference between conspiracy theories and conspiracies, the notorious anti-Semitic pamphlet, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, that is a conspiracy theory. But there is a real-life conspiracy, which was that anti-Semitic right-wing elements of the Russian government actually printed that pamphlet specifically and secretly with the intention of increasing anti-Semitic sentiment in the population. So the real-life conspiracy was this, the secret publication of these documents to support the goals of the Russian government.
So one of the biggest takeaways I had from this film, in terms of my thoughts and the message of it, the moral, if you want to call it, the moral center of it, just the guiding viewpoint that it has, it is not paranoid enough.
You're saying QAnon is not paranoid enough?
No, of course, in the sense that it thinks that there are, it thinks that, again, Donald Trump is the, was simply pretending to be a pedophile.
Yeah, with his lifelong friendship with Jeffrey Epstein, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was doing white hat pedophilia.
Sneaking into the girls' dressing rooms at the Miss Teen USA, yeah, yeah.
He was building a cover story, what do you want to say? And then, of course, there is a secret organization within the military brass that actually was trying to stop the Iraq war.
Which is also very revealing of the American rights transformation over the past decade or so.
That is a fascinating transition. All it took was Trump to give them permission to admit that the Iraq war was what it was.
All those same people, I would think that most of the people in the Q movement who might oppose the war in Iraq would probably very eagerly support a war in Iran or even Venezuela.
No, this is not principled anti-imperialism or anything like that.
I think very little. Reactionary politics is very rarely principled because it's always so visceral.
No, they just want the guns on the border instead of over there in Iraq.
Of course, my view of this is that it is not paranoid enough. Again, the little glimpses we get into, say, the assassination of Charles Carroll at the very beginning of the film on the Space Needle, the attempted assassination on the airplane of Senator Dillingham, who is set up to be this. And, of course, there is a scene in which one of his aides comes back with a newspaper from the stand and says, oh, man, they really hate you, right? You know, so the media clearly hates him. Media also hates, it is implied, again, not explicitly stated because they could have tightened up the script a bit. But, you know, they're under a lot of pressure. Of course, Hammond, Senator Hammond is his rival who is Republican-coded. Although Russian Sam will push back on me on this.
Oh, yeah, because you were thinking Russian Sam, he was kind of like a Jimmy Carter stand-in, is that right?
Yeah, he's absolutely a Jimmy Carter stand-in, in my opinion. First of all, he's got the same haircut. Second of all, the speech that he gives to the assembly is just very much reminded me of Carter's famous American malaise quote.
He never actually said malaise.
Oh, of course that would have been several years after this movie came out. But yeah.
Of course, but that was really the zeitgeist. This was what Carter was elected on, and then he screwed everything up by becoming the first proponent of neoliberalism. But that's a whole different story.
So I think that he is very clearly Republican coded, and I think the evidence for this is certainly the repeating motifs of using images of the Founding Fathers, the fact that he's a very Southern man. And again, you have to remember, this is a 1974 film. Southern politicians are, especially those who are attempting to cast some sort of like populist lens, which is what he was kind of trying to do, is that, or at least I think that's how they were trying to characterize Hammond, is as this Southern populist. I think it's very clear. He's supposed to be, if I remember correctly, he's sort of like a big businessman from the South, you know, very wealthy man, striking sort of this populist tune, appealing to, you know, just it showing pictures, you know, of Washington, Jefferson, Madison, you know, all these founding fathers. I think that it's very clear that really what this is these are two unfavorable candidates. No one in power wants either to become president. However, it is still the perspective of the film that rather than simply, let's say, rigging a primary, which again, the DNC riots of like the late 60s, those were not that far behind in memory.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the strange thing.
Especially when the novel was written.
Exactly. Daily era Chicago, it was just accepted that primary, you would think that it would be commonly accepted that primaries were simply completely rigged and completely bullshit and completely meaningless. But yet, in order for all of this America to work, everyone had to at least pretend that they believed that a vote actually mattered, especially in a primary in this era. It is still the perspective of a film that, oh no, they would never attempt to rig a presidential primary because someone that the political establishment was so afraid of becoming president, they would have him assassinated, but they would never stoop to, you know, just blatantly steal a primary through illicit means. Again, it is the film is not paranoid enough. The film still believes in all of these institutions.
JFK had stolen votes within living memory at the primary.
Oh, I mean, again, everyone had stolen votes.
It's how you did things. It was how the party worked.
Yeah, there literally was not such a thing as, like, genuine fair primaries until fair, quote-unquote, by modern standards. Because we don't need to get into it, but we all know what fucking the primaries are like now. That did not exist until the earliest, maybe the mid to late 70s, maybe at the earliest.
I don't even know if I'd, honestly.
I would, again, that's what I'm saying, at the very earliest. Again, after the embarrassment in Chicago.
Yeah, they got egg on their face in public.
Right. They had to give something. But again, the people at the time genuinely thought, and by people, I mean, you know, whoever went into making this movie, genuinely thought nobody would risk rigging votes in primaries. So therefore, assassinations were the only way to stop candidates. Part of this was, you know, seen because so many candidates had simply, they simply did have so much momentum that they could not be stopped simply electorally, right? Bobby Kennedy could not simply be stopped. It had gone on too long and it had gone on too strongly, the Bobby Kennedy campaign, for them to just simply rig the primary, right?
So that's why you think that's why it was necessary to maybe bring in Dr. Jolly.
Yeah, I think that's the most well, that's JFK, but yeah. And with Bobby Kennedy specifically, that is, you know, if they could have done a far less, again, it would have been less risky to simply rig it if they could have. There is no such sense in the film that either of these candidates are at the level of momentum that like a Bobby Kennedy was going into California, right? There's simply no evidence of that. I mean, there's not a lot of evidence the other way, but there's certainly no evidence that they are unstoppable. The notion that you get is that they're sort of, both of them are kind of off to the side. The media doesn't want to fucking touch either of them.
Although they are described in kind of Kennedy-esque terms, like the first guy.
The very, very first guy was.
To take a step back from the movie for a second, just to wrap this up, if Bobby Kennedy was assassinated by the state, just curious, what interests do you think would have been behind that? That would have been willing to go so far that they would employ these bizarre hypnotic tactics to do so.
So that's a big question, right?
Probably the same people as who killed his brother, given that that was a big worry that he might have reopened that case.
RFK, in fact, even prior to running, was asking around very prominent figures, who killed my brother? Was anyone in the CIA involved? Because he certainly fucking suspected Alan Dulles. He did not fucking trust Alan Dulles as far as he could throw that guy. You know, I would absolutely think it is probably basically not necessarily the same one-to-one elements as killed his brother, right? But I think that it is certainly the same milieu. Certainly, he certainly would not have entered the presidency
as anything but hostile to the CIA. And if you want to talk about the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, the best book I have read on this topic is a book called A Lie Too Big to Fail by Lisa Pease. It is a fantastically researched book on the entire assassination, from who could have been behind it to the very forensic evidence of the case itself. So I would suggest anyone interested in that absolutely go check that book out.
And Lisa Pease, please unblock James from Twitter.
But yeah, so that is who I think would have been behind it, is those seeking to prevent a president who was openly hostile to such agencies, as well as prevent the election of a president who was so openly in favor of military withdrawal on such an immediate term.
And I guess the fact that we can't really know for sure, possibly ever, does sort of bring us all the way back to kind of the thesis of this movie. It's that terror of when you don't really know, and all you have left is the paranoia. When you know there's something up, you know there must be something going on that you can tell, but you can't tell exactly what, and you can't tell exactly who. Well, thank you so much, James, for coming on. This really has been a fun one. All right. Well, hey, well. On that note, thank you guys all so much. This has been fun.
Absolutely. I had an absolute blast.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you guys all, and we'll see you next week for another episode of Gladio for Europe.